So, last time we kind of got back into our ethics and we talked about euthanasia. Not teenagers in China. That's my joke. Not youth in Asia.
I appreciate that one.
Got it? That's the dad jokes.
Euthanasia.
And I actually made my Marvel Avengers reference because the you means good and Thanatos means death. Good death is where euthanasia is. Thanos.
So that's where that word came from.
Yeah.
Wow. I never.
And we kind of went over just terminology. Like, there's kind of some different layers in euthanasia. There's what you'd call passive and active. Okay, so just kind of hit. You look on page 8 in the handout. So active refers to taking a purposeful action, whereas passive refers to withholding something. So kind of there at the bottom, giving a lethal dose of drugs to someone is an active euthanasia. Removing a feeding tube to remove and take away food and nourishment is a passive. So either way, you're causing the death, either actively by intervening or passively by withholding something. And then there's also different voluntary, involuntary, non-voluntary, whether or not the wishes of the person are for death, not for death, or unknown. So today we're going to, I was just kind of going to summarize them up here, but we've got a few cases that people would make for euthanasia. So, like, why might we argue, or why might people argue for euthanasia? Okay. So the first one would be the quality, right? Their quality of life. So here's kind of how the argument would go. The mere fact that something has biological life, says one proponent, whether human or non-human, is relatively unimportant from an ethics point of view, or ethical. What matters is biographical life. It's the sum of one's aspirations, decisions, activities, projects, and human relationships. The facts of a person's biographical life are those of that person's history and character. They are the interests that are important and worthwhile from the point of view of the person himself or herself. The value of one's biographical life is the person, the value it has for that person, and something has value if its loss would harm that person. So we'll say for is its what do we call that? It's like quality of life. So the idea is if you have no quality, then why you basically don't have life. That's the argument.
Yeah. The $1 million baby argument. Ever seen that movie?
Mm-hmm. And it's especially constructed in a way in that where her value is based around her physical abilities to, she was a boxer, right? And so everything centers around her growth and her training and her working her way up to this championship. So her life is centered around that value. And then she's injured and is paralyzed from the neck down. Right? So her biographical value is totally, that's removed. And so in that case, she desires death. That's kind of what's going on there. Okay. So what do you, any issues with quality of life, that kind of ethical issues that may come up with this kind of view, if you're saying, yeah, talking with someone, they say, well, if the person doesn't have any quality of life, why should we force them or make them continue to live on?
I think you can use Joni Erickson Tada is a perfect example of someone could have said the quality of her life is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And look how long she's lived, and look how much movement she acquired.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And even got married, and, you know, and she's impacted thousands of people. So to say that she had no value because of that, you can't say that. Are you talking about that, or is that not part of the...
No, that's right. That's right. Now, Johnny, was she a teenager, dove into water, paralyzed, right?
Yeah, and supposedly she was the same from the
neck down.
But, first she painted with her mouth, with a brush, and learned all that stuff. But if you ever watch her live, which I have many times, I haven't seen her live, but I've watched her, she has quite a bit of movement. It's shocking how much she can actually do with her hands and everything now. And plus, she's had cancer. I mean, it's it's amazing.
Written books.
Yeah. Well, she's done more than that. She's just, got live television spots or TV spots and radio spots, and so she's just impacted a lot of people.
Yeah.
And you just think, well, see, her own thought of that she wasn't worth anything or had any value, are you determining that against that person or others or God? That's what it says, you have value.
Yeah.
Who's determining what's in the quality?
Yeah, that's, I guess, the point.
Yeah. So, a couple of things that you brought up, like, right, who's determining it? And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but like,
there are cases sometimes where you don't know, based upon so many other factors and even advances, whether or not the condition you're in will be permanent or not.
Another thing is where do you draw the line? What is qualified as not a quality of life?
Yeah. So is it like, it's, they kind of give this, it's not like a binary,
this person is not, no quality, and this person, it's like this, you assign different values, and so where should we encourage?
And it's also like in the eugenics thing, it could even be considered, it could be like this person could be an alcoholic later on in life,
And how do you guys think about, something I was thinking about is, someone from this point of view might, their argument might be that, okay, well, we're going to let every individual determine their own quality. And so it's not, how could it ever be evil if none of us are telling them, we're letting them decide. How could that be, what's kind of the problem?
Yeah, people don't make decisions in a vacuum. We are influenced in a multiple, there's a multiplicity of influences. I look at, if, let's say, you have a pastor who gets caught having an affair and is just publicly shamed and humiliated, his wife leaves him, his kids no longer respect him, he can never be a pastor again, and that's the only thing he's ever known. What's his quality of life? It would be low, right? Mm-hmm. It's practically over. Mm-hmm. And even in that, he's been influenced by a lot of other people with that too, right? He'll never be a pastor again. The wife leaves him. His kids don't respect him. People just don't make those kinds of decisions in the vacuum. We're always influenced.
Yeah. I think of, there's a, like, it, I saw this scene. There's a story of, I think the movie's called The Revenant, which I don't think I would suggest it, but in the scene, the guy, I think it's based on partially a true story, he's mauled by a bear, like kind of frontiersman type thing. He's just like, oh, he's dead, he's totally dead. He's kind of laying there and just can't move. And this guy is kind of, they're watching him to try and wait for him, and they're trying to survive, and he's saying, you just say the word and I'll end it all. And the guy can't move, can't speak. He said, just blink. If you blink, that lets me know that. And so he's like trying to keep his eyes open the whole time, He's just, and so imagine being someone who wants to live, right? But everyone's just let us know.
Yeah.
We'll be merciful. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because it doesn't end at you make the decision. It never stops there. It's like, you're not making the right decision.
Right.
So now we need to step in and make, or you're incapable, like you said.
Yes. Yeah.
So we'll make the decision for you.
Yeah. So that kind of, these are, some of these are ideas. So the second one, utilitarian. Okay, so it's kind of, we're now we're thinking about not just the individual. So an early death can be good for society. For instance, a cash-strapped family will not be forced to go into poverty with medical expenses so that they may postpone the inevitable. And so it's kind of setting up the scenario, someone's certain to die. It's going to, maybe it's going to be tomorrow, but it could be several months. And those several months might totally wreck and destroy this family. So any differences there, added things to think about?
Once again, that's a real slippery slope, because who makes the decision and at what point do you decide that that's the case? You
know? Yeah.
So there's, every instance is different.
Yeah. It, I did bring, I, we're returning the this book, I've mentioned it several times, I wrote it from the Davises, but it's The Hiding Place, and there's a little passage I wanted to read from here. So it's towards the end of the book, so Corey and Betsy, these two 50-ish year old sisters, are in a work camp, concentration camp, with the Nazis. And they've been there quite a while. And she says, one morning, three women from Barracks 28 lingered inside a few minutes to avoid the cold. All the following weeks, the entire barracks were punished by an extra hour at attention. So basically, each morning they would come out and have to stand at attention for a certain amount of time while they counted everyone. The lights on at the Lagerstrasse were not even lit when we were driven from our bunks at 3:30 a.m. It was during this pre-inspection lineup one morning that I saw what I had till then refused to believe. Headlights appeared at the far end of the long street wavering over the snow. Trucks with open flatbeds in the rear were approaching, splattering slush as they passed. They pulled up at the front door of the hospital. The door opened and a nurse appeared, supporting an old woman whose legs buckled as she limped down the steps. The nurse lifted her gently onto the back of a truck. They were pouring out of the door now, leaning on the arms of nurses and hospital helpers. The old, the ill. Last of all came orderlies with stretchers between them. Our eyes took in every detail of the scene. Our brains refused. We had known, of course, that when overcrowding reached a certain point, the sickest were taken to the brick building at the foot of the great square smokestack. But that these women here in front of us, these very ones, it was not possible. Above all, I could not put it together with the kindly behavior of the nurses. That one in the truck just ahead, bending solicitously, even tenderly over her patient, what was passing through her mind just now? You know? And it's this, that utilitarian, because they were working at this camp. So during the day, they were supposed to build radios and knit socks. And they had a hospital, but the point of the hospital was to regain enough strength to go back and do more work. Yeah. But it just strikes me that she saw, you know, and the nurses, and that they seemed to believe that they were showing care in some sense.
And there is a utilitarian, but it's a cash-strapped family, that's one thing. But if it's a cash-strapped society, what do you do?
Yeah.
I watched a little clip, I think it was Denmark, and talked to an official in Denmark. And he demonstrated how much money they saved in their healthcare system by aborting babies that had Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. And cool and calmly, and he is very, see, this is justified. This is how much money our healthcare system saved.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, you could say that about every illness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true. A heart attack, how much you save it.
Yeah.
Hit and close the curtain.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, or any other illness, really. Mm-hmm. Cancer.
Yeah.
So that justification applies if you want to follow that line to anything.
Yeah. It's a super, super depressing to think about the reality of some of the...
But there's people that think that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until it's them.
Right. Okay. I'm going to... It's my notes.
Bad.
All right, so here we go. Talk about this one. I think is it demonstrates something that's at the heart of a lot of these ethical views. Is that's this idea of autonomy. So, freedom of choice. So it's wrong to impose our view of life and death upon someone else. And so the idea is that each person, again, they should have the freedom to choose whether they live or die. And you could give this, they give this analogy that, what's theft? Okay, taking something that you do not give me permission to take. Now, if I give you permission to take it, then when you, if you do take it, then it's not, that's not theft, because I've given you permission. I may not give it to you directly, but if I say, yeah, you can have that, come by my house, take it, I say that's not theft. And so then they try and, the argument is, think about that analogy in terms of a person's life. If you give them permission, if I give you permission to take my life in terms of the euthanasia, who am I to say that that's wrong? Why is that wrong? If I grant permission, it's just giving that up.
So we call this. Freedom of choice.
It's their body, their choice.
Yeah, but it's not. It's, I mean, it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It belongs to God, so they really don't have a choice, in my opinion. It's not theirs.
And I think also, you could see how sometimes you talk about. Like, think about Johnny Erickson Tata and the impact that she had on other people. Belongs to God and to others. It may be, you know, maybe there's a husband and wife, and one is suffering. And in one sense, it can be viewed as, I'm going to relieve my spouse, you know, but at the other hand, the spouse may not want to be relieved. They may want you to stay, they don't want you to escape.
Even that.
Would you put then a do not resuscitate legal document in that category?
Oh, we're getting to those.
Okay.
Yeah, we're getting to those. Good. It's
yeah.
A good point.
I mean, freedom of choice assumes you have the ability to make the perfect choice all the time.
Yeah.
So you go back to, let's say, the Mayans and they do human sacrifice. Well, that choice is made because they believe they'll be dwelling with the gods eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they knew that they were going to go to hell after that, they might make a different choice.
Yeah.
Or if somebody's been told that you have a fatal disease, they'll make a choice to go ahead and commit suicide. But what if it was found out with a second opinion? Actually, they just discovered the cure last week.
Yeah.
So that's the problem with the human choice, is choices are based off of information, and it's based off of having accurate information, which is not always the case.
Yeah.
Like, do you wear a mask or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great example with type 1 diabetes. You know, it used to be, you got diagnosed, the person gradually went, you know, lost weight, lost consciousness, went into coma, and so it's terminal, right? And so, but then when, I just read the story not long ago, you know, they developed human insulin and they gave it in as like resurrection, you know, it's like they... What was previously terminal had changed, and so that constantly is, again, is it permanent? You know, do you, and I guess the other thing, like you said, is it informed?
That would also, that'd be too easily corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
between the stage euthanasia. My wife wanted me to kill her.
Oh, yeah.
She did.
She didn't at the time, but she wrote this out. It looks like my handwriting, just because she was under.
She said, "I want to die," and I just said, "Okay."
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah, the depravity of how everything can, and that's kind of, you'll see that. Not only is the view of our life different, but the underlying assumptions about the morality of the individual, the knowledge of the individual that's making the decisions, all of those things are from a different viewpoint.
Now, you look at Jonestown and all those people who committed ritual suicide. Was that really their choice? Did they really have freedom to make that decision?
Did they know it wasn't Kool-Aid?
Or like in Waco with Koresh, then they set the set on fire, you know, and there's babies and, you know, lots of,
yeah,
and not of their own choice. One other good point, you kind of mentioned it, I think you mentioned it here, but like in the idea of theft, or whether it's theft or not, if I give you permission. If you change your mind, you can always, hey, I want that back. Yeah. Right? There's a certain finality with this that's not necessarily there with some other ethical choices. Yeah. See. Okay, and then this is our last one. It's a demonstration of mercy. And we talked about this some with suffering, right? With suicide, that the Bible's view of suffering is vastly different than the world's view that good can come out of suffering. And for the believer, God always, Piper says, God doesn't waste one drop of suffering. It's all used for a purpose, to accomplish some good. Last week, we talked about, were there any biblical examples of euthanasia? You were here last week. You guys missed that. Were there any biblical?
All the armor bearers.
Although we said, yeah, it's a bad burden to be the armor bearer, because it's like, in the two accounts that we read, that possibly, right, Saul and his armor bearer said, oh, I've been hurt, you know, and the armor bearer wouldn't do it, but then you read the Malachite claims that I've found him, and so he requested it, and then we read about, what's the guy's name? The other guy later in, huh?
Abimelech.
Abimelech, you know, and his head gets crushed, and his armor bearer, strike me so that I'm not killed by a woman, was his claim. And kind of the two, one commentator that I read said, you know, those are like Saul's was like a mercy, you know, because I'm suffering in the pain, I'm in the pains of death. And then Abimelech is like the dying with dignity, like, I'll go out the way, not by a woman.
Yeah, so it wasn't necessarily to relieve suffering, but preserve honor.
Right. Yeah, it didn't have. So, when we think about, like, just going back through, a lot of the reasoning behind why we would oppose and be against euthanasia are similar to we would say with euthanasia, right? Is that, you know, we're in the image of God, and so, you know, our life is not our own. We don't have the right to take someone else's life or our own life, because we're created in God's image, and so we get that from Genesis, and we get that from his punishment, death penalty for taking life. And you've kind of mentioned there the slippery slope, right? In every one of these, it's really hard to, if it's okay here, then why not? Why not in other places? Let's read just a couple of these passages. If you look at value of suffering, it's kind of flip there. So, Heather or Joe, one of you guys want to get Romans 5, 3 through 5. And Alan, Sandy, you guys want to get 1 Peter 1. You guys want to get 2 Corinthians 4, 17 and 12, 10. And then you guys can read out Job. The whole book. No, that's all right. We'll just...
How much more time do we have?
Maybe that's a little too much. Okay, so Romans 5, 3 through 5.
Not only that, but we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us.
Alright, 1 Peter
6 through 9 says, in this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your soul.
Yeah. And then those two verses from 2 Corinthians.
For the slight momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. For the sake of Christ, then I am content with weakness, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it kind of, to me, you could kind of divide kind of your reason as well. A lot of times, if you have an unbeliever, someone who's lost, all of these things are now void, right? Because they're condemning them to hell. So, right, you're sending them to eternal conscious torment and punishment. So none of these things really are an argument. If you're a believer, we have a totally different view of suffering. And so those passages that we read really help to inform that even if you have heaven awaiting you, God teaches us that our suffering has great, great value and purpose. It's not something to escape from, but to endure and to...
Yeah, I think one thing, if we were to be the authors of our own life, how much suffering would we write into it? There would be none. Yeah, so I think one thing that suffering does is it reminds us that we're not in control of our own life. This is actually God's story being told through us. And our suffering is part of the story to bring in glory.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be much more shallow and superficial. Mine would be. I would not have endured really any.
Yeah, and in that tree, like shallow people are people who just haven't suffered enough. I mean, there is a depth to people who have suffered.
And so, you know, the other thing is that we talked about, you've got the slippery slope that we've talked about several times, and that idea of medically, at what point do you determine that someone's terminally ill? And so you may never know. It's hard to say, oh yeah, in 1 month we're going to find this cure. It's not really a predictable process. You know, medicine kind of advances it at an unpredictable rate, but... And it's an interesting, you guys brought up how, you know, you could make the argument that every disease, you know, you could save healthcare and you could save society. And so it's an interesting that we've made such great advances in medicine, that it actually has created much, much more disease because all the people that would have died in the past are now living on. And so we're kind of trying to have it both ways. We want to have all the advances to stop all the illnesses and cure all the illnesses that we can, but we don't want the illnesses to be here. And so it's this fighting with the curse of death to try and avoid it, but also be free from. Are you going to comment?
I'm just thinking, like, with the slippery slope is there's no clear moral boundaries. And that's always a dangerous thing when you're dealing with questions of life and death.
Yeah.
People, whoever's in power makes these decisions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or the most forceful right. opinion, right. even if they're not, like, in a family situation, sometimes there's someone that just won't ever be, they're the most stubborn. And so people just kind of go along.
And there is a danger. I mean, euthanasia ultimately is rejecting God's authorship over life. And so when a society does that, society rejects God's authorship over life, and they are now entrusted with making the decision, mm-hmm. Really in defiance to God. It's like, what kind of decisions do you think they're going to make? Mm-hmm. It will be in the best interest of the most dominant tribe.
And like you're saying, that it's really, just another outworking of that central rejection. So when we put man as the authority, a lot of those arguments, so if I'm the one that decides, if I'm the ultimate authority, everything's totally different. So I thought it would be good, let me see who we're at. Yeah, we've got some time. Talk about exceptions, okay? Right? Are there any exceptions? Okay. So the traditional view allows for withholding or withdrawing treatment in some cases where certain circumstances exist. So what are circumstances? Patient is terminal, death is imminent, treatment is judged extraordinary, and death is not directly intended. Okay, so let's work through an example where the patient is dying, they're terminal, and death is imminent. They're going to die within the minutes or hours. Treatment is extraordinary, meaning we'll talk about what does that mean here below. And death is not directly intended. So we're talking about an exception might be withholding an extreme amount of effort and allowing that person to die without putting them through and putting an extreme, extraordinary amount of effort into trying to save someone whose death is right. Kind of on the doorstep. And so let's talk about what is extraordinary versus ordinary, and then we'll kind of think about some scenarios. So, right, ordinary means that all medicines, treatments, and operations that offer a reasonable hope of benefit without placing undue burdens on the patient, like pain or serious inconvenience. Extraordinary means, or sometimes called heroic means, they're not ordinary. They involve excessive burdens and do not necessarily offer reasonable hope of benefit. So, you got any examples of if you're in the ER and what helps to maybe think through, like what's something that might be done where you'd say, does it really have a reasonable hope of benefit? And it's like extraordinary heroic measures, is that based?
Hold those?
Well, when I was trying to think through this, I was thinking about CPR. So, like, how long do you continue CPR where it's like...
So when it's a child, it's forever. You go forever. Way past.
Mm-hmm. Because I've heard, we did a story when we were training CPR at school that they did CPR for like 45 minutes.
I've done it for over an hour.
Yeah. And the person came back to life. Mm-hmm. So...
Not usually.
Right.
Neurologically intact.
Mm-hmm.
But I had this happened to my parents because they, my sister was born with cerebral palsy. Well, so they didn't know that mm-hmm. she was, had an anoxic brain injury when she was born, seizures and all that stuff. And we were Catholic at the time, and so they called the priest and it was like, just you know, basically the ordinary things that you would provide to a basic to a human being. So food, water, you know, shelter, mm-hmm. clothing. So she was in an ICU, and overnight she deteriorated, and without calling my parents, they put her on a vent. So they intubated her and put her on a life support machine. Mm-hmm. And they would not have done that had that, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they also told her she would not live past however many years old, five mm-hmm. or six, and she's going to be 40 August 1st.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, and she's with us, and she's been a blessing to mm-hmm. us. I mean, no one would go back now and do anything differently.
Mm-hmm.
But to them, that would have been a heroic measure
mm-hmm.
that they were not planning on taking.
Yeah. And I think we want to make a distinction in that. So like an exception doesn't, we're not saying that in this case, do euthanasia. That's not what an exception means. It's saying a person may not be held morally
culpable
of murder if they do not pursue these heroic measures. Whereas many cases, people do choose them, and sometimes they work out, you know, where the person lives and survives. That kind of makes sense. We're not saying, oh, in this case, okay, do it all the time.
Because the pathology is running its course. The medical intervention is not killing them.
It's almost medicine has muddied the water on this, though. It's made, I think, mm-hmm. difficult.
Very much.
Because there are things sometimes that you can do, to what end.
Right.
So, like chemo. You know, you have somebody with, you know, who's suffering cancer, mm-hmm. and you're giving them more suffering by giving them chemotherapy. And only prolonging their life by weeks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that ethical?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, if they want it, I'm sure.
Right.
But if they don't want it, I don't think they should be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that it's very good to remember that if you are facing a situation like this, there are many situations where it requires much prayer, thought, counsel, and it's not just a quick cut and dry, oh, we always do this, right? Every case, and so for example, turn to kind of page 13. The distinction between ordinary and extraordinary should not be made abstractly for kinds of treatments, but should be made in terms of kinds of treatments for specific persons in specific situations, meaning that every situation is going to be unique, and deciding what would be a heroic measure may be slightly different from individual to individual in circumstance. Different treatments, different places.
You know what's interesting too is that you know, we used to have chaplains,
right?
And they were on your ethics boards, and they were on your, and they were advising physicians, and they were mm-hmm. advising families. And you'd have chaplains on staff, and you would always ask the family, "Do you want
mm-hmm.
your pastor to come help you make these decisions?" But when I've asked families that, I get this look like, you know, I had to put. They had us. They had all, like, I think we were the Flint Hills Christian Church, and I don't even think they had your name on our list.
Most chaplains.
Oh, I know.
Are extremely liberal.
Yes.
And they'll advise you to go ahead and put them out of misery.
Yeah. The last couple that I worked with were like
mm-hmm.
that.
Terrible.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Terrible. But that's not how it used to be.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing to point out too, and I thought kind of thought about this a bit, is that idea of. Should be noted where it talks about a feeding tube versus like a ventilator,
yeah.
right? So what's the difference between a feeding tube? So, you know, when you think about a feeding tube, you are removing something that's not necessarily helping their body to function. It's just the food and sustenance that they need to digest, right? So they're not... Right, so they don't die from any disease, they die from starvation. So we remove, whereas, say a ventilator, if you remove a ventilator, if their body breathes, you know, the oxygen is still there available. You're removing the artificial functioning of this body organ. But you're saying, and I think that's true, there's a interesting paragraph there at the bottom where, you know, defining what death is becomes more difficult when you can artificially cause a heart to beat, or, you know, you can do CPR and make the heart push blood through, and you can force the body to breathe.
Yeah, you can actually, you know, they'll bypass when people, they would take people on bypass. We do that in ERs now for codes. They put them on ECMO.
Yeah.
And they take all their blood supply and put it through a machine that oxygenates it and brings it back.
False, like a mechanical heart. So they wouldn't even need the heart, right? They wouldn't even need the...
bypass the heart and lung.
So, yeah. So, like Dave mentioned, you know, if you're facing this, seek wisdom, but from a Bible-believing or pro-life person, pastor, chaplain, doctor, someone who's informed but has a biblical worldview. And think about, you know, the Bible's perspective on not only the sanctity of life, but suffering. And pray about it. Yeah. I think, you know, letter E, seek to show mercy in every way possible, short of actively causing death. So you want to, we're not, the Bible doesn't encourage us to just mercilessly, okay, we want you to suffer. We want to show as much mercy and ease suffering and help people through suffering, but we want to stop short of actively killing someone, taking their life. So, I'll read their conclusion here. Euthanasia, it's a cultural battle regarding the ongoing war of the worldviews. You know, I think about this a lot. How many years ago was the Terry Schiavo? It's been quite a while.
That was
20 years ago?
George W.
So, Terry Schiavo, have you guys ever heard of her? So, I don't remember the details, but she was on a feeding tube, and there was a dispute among, I don't know if it was the parents and the husband.
And the husband, yeah.
One wanted to continue using the feeding tube, and one wanted to remove it. And so it went. Did it go Supreme Court?
Yeah, the husband wanted to remove it.
Yeah.
Now, was she considered brain dead, or did they?
That was under dispute.
Yeah.
According to her parents, she did respond.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this, the issue addresses a lot of underlying views on what do we view about life. Who's the authority that gives the value and the quality of life? When does a life have purpose? You know, for the believer, we don't need to fear death. It is our enemy, but it's defeated through Jesus Christ. And we also know that the Lord will put an end to death and the euthanasia debate when he returns. So we need to warn people, especially the unbeliever, that not only would taking their own life be a sin against God and assault on the image of God, but it would thrust them into eternity of hell. Ending on a ominous note.
Yes.
We have any fun subjects coming up?
I don't know what the next one is.
Yeah, we haven't.
But, I mean, euthanasia is one of those things to kind of get straight out. I know of a situation where this guy had, like, he had a stroke and his brain began to swell. And so what they did to save his life is they removed part of his skull and put it into his stomach, which is what you do with that. And so that stabilized him. But he is unresponsive. I mean, just... can't talk, respond, or anything, and he's just being put alive by a ventilator and these other machines. Mm. And so now they don't quite know what to do.
Yeah.
So, the wife is having a hard time like letting go until he's been in this state for 2.5 years.
Oh.
So I think that was something where that was extraordinary means.
Mm-hmm.
And so is he dead? Is he alive? Well, we don't. No one really knows. So.
We had a real life situation like that with my dad, and he had a stroke, and he had signed and wanted to sign a do not resuscitate thing. And so later on, then he fell. He was paralyzed pretty much his left side. He fell in the bathroom and had a severe head injury, and mom called 911. And when they showed up, she showed him that, and they said, well, we can't do that. And so they revived him and took him to the hospital, and they put in a ventilator, and he had the extent of his head injury we didn't know, of course, at that time, but he was breathing very struggled, and even with the ventilator, and he's just hanging on by, you can tell, just a little bit. And so the doctor there, he said, you got to make a decision here if we take this ventilator out or not, and what will happen. Well, he told us he really didn't know, but he said, I can give him a shot of morphine, and that will relax him enough that if he can breathe on his own, he will. And so I got three sisters. They all looked at me and said, what are we going to do? And after we were with him for a while, we decided that was the best
mm-hmm.
option.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't pass away right then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right or wrong, you got to decide.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there's a certain, although the details are very muddied, I think there's a certain spirit of, are we seeking to cause death, or are we allowing a person to die of a sickness, disease, injury that would cause their death, apart from some our miraculous.
But because he had that do not resuscitate pledge signed, that helped us, I think, to
mm-hmm.
make that decision.
Mm-hmm.